Hi, I'm Sam, and I'd like to welcome Chuck Lavelle. Chuck is a piano player who played with the Allman Brothers, the Rolling Stones, and even did a tour with David Gilmour. Well, Chuck, I know I was listening to a lot of your solo work the other night, and I noticed on your like all instrumental piano album, Forever Blue, you played a song called Ashokan Farewell. And that's just not a song I hear a lot on like rock and roll artists. I don't hear a lot of rock and roll people playing Ashokan Farewell. So can you tell me a little bit about how you chose to have that song on your record?
Well, for your listeners that may not know, that song was used quite often in the Civil War documentary series by Ken Burns. And it's just such a beautiful melody. It sounds like an ancient melody, but it was actually written in more modern times by a violinist. And I heard about the song years back when I was on tour with Eric Clapton, and Russ Titelman was a producer for Eric back in the early 90s. And he asked me if I'd ever heard that song. And I remembered about it from the series. So he said, you know, I think it'd translate well into piano. And he was right. So beautiful, beautiful melody. It's been recorded by a good many different people, but I just love the melody. It sounds like some, you know, long time Irish or Scottish piece.
Yeah. No, that's a beautiful one. That really stuck out to me when I was listening to all of your work. And I know you also, just like 10 or so years ago, you played a concert, I guess, called All My Friends with Greg Allman. And you guys closed that with Will the Circle Be Unbroken, an old Carter Family song. Now, what are your thoughts on the Carter Family and that song? And like, how did I guess they fit into your life?
Well, Greg used to play that song when we were on tour with him in 1974, after we had recorded the Laid Back album. And as I recall, I think we used it towards the end or perhaps even as a closer. And so, you know, it's a bit of a traditional thing to do for Greg and with Greg. And so I thought it was a good call to use on that project. And by the way, I was so very proud and pleased that we were able to do that for Greg before he passed away. He certainly deserved it. And it was a wonderful, wonderful night with all kinds of guest artists paying homage to Greg and to be involved myself personally. You know, of course, Don was the musical director, but since I had played on those records, you know, the Laid Back record and the Allman Brothers records, you know, I kind of was maybe assistant musical director since I knew so much of that material. But it was an incredibly special night, and it certainly put a big smile on Greg's face.
Yeah, I mean, after one heck of a music career, that's why you ended it with that song. It's really just, you know, tying all ends together. It's a beautiful piece.
It is indeed. And, you know, I think Greg got it from Jeff Hanna from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. I don't know if you know the story, but before there was an Allman Brothers band, there was the Hourglass, which was Greg and Dwayne and another set of musicians. And the Hourglass had played in St. Louis, and their manager, I believe it was Bill McEwen, heard the band and told them, you guys have to go to California. You know, you're going to be a huge hit out there. I think you'll have a great career. And so they did. They went from St. Louis out to California, to L.A., and started playing around. And they got signed by Liberty Records at the time, which was not a huge label, but they had some resource. And they did two records on Liberty. But getting back to the Circle song, that's a song that Nitty Gritty used to do quite a lot. And I think there's a documentary where they close out their documentary with that song on a live performance. So it's you know, it goes around the block. It's a family thing.
Yeah, of course. That's a nice little story there. I was watching your documentary, like, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, and I noticed in it you said you only really ever met Dwayne once, and it was barely even a meeting, right? You just like brushed past him. And as someone that almost filled his shoes in the Allman Brothers Band, how did Dwayne play a role on your musical career?
Well, you have to understand that I heard Greg and Dwayne when they were the Allman Joys back in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where I grew up. They often played a place called Fort Brandon Armory in Tuscaloosa. And you know, I guess I would have been 13, maybe 14 years old and fledgling musician. I had heard about those guys, and there were other bands that would make that circuit and come through Tuscaloosa and play. And because we were trying to learn, we loved listening to those bands and hearing them and, you know, kind of seeing what it was all about. And the Joys were just fantastic. They were really a great band. I mean, they were way ahead of their time. Of course, back then they were doing only cover songs, but for instance, they did Paperback Writer by the Beatles, which was a pretty complicated song with all the harmonies and everything. And they just knocked it out of the park, man. They were so good. And so I heard Dwayne, I heard Greg early on a few times in Alabama. And I always thought, wow, these guys have got it. They're somewhere up the line, they're going to be stars. And so it was sort of ironic that fate led me to Macon, Georgia. And then, you know, I never got to know the guys in my early days in Macon. I was working with, well, the first band I had was called Sundown, and it was kind of a combination of some musicians from Macon and some musicians from Tuscaloosa. We did one record on the Ampex label. It was a short-lived band. I think we lasted about a year. And then I got a gig with Alex Taylor, who was James Taylor's elder brother. And that was my first experience touring the country. We had six guys in a Ford LTD station wagon driving all over the U.S. and even up into Canada. And so during this process, being that this activity was taking place in Macon, of course you would run into the Allman Brothers Band. You know, you would hear them, you knew their records, they were on the label, you know. But I did not really know them personally. And then, you know, when I, well, as the story that I told in the documentary was about a recording session with the band Cowboy. It was Scott Boyer and Tommy Talton were the principal members of the band, principal songwriters. And there's a pretty famous song called Please Be With Me that Eric Clapton recorded on one of his records that Scott wrote. And so Dwayne had come in to Muscle Shoals to play, I think he was playing either dobro or slide guitar on Please Be With Me, the Cowboy version. And he had finished, and I was coming in to play on that record. My plane landed. I walked in the studio, walked down the hall, and Dwayne had his guitar case, and he had just finished his session, and he was walking out. And we literally passed each other and smiled at each other and said, hey, man, you know, and that was it. The only time I ever spoke to him. I wish I'd have gotten to know him. I tell you, I've been watching this documentary about the Big House in Macon, which is, of course, where most of the Allman Brothers lived for a period of time when they were first on the record label. And there's some really interesting interviews with the guys. And this documentary was done quite some time back, right? And so there's fairly young Butch Trucks talking about Dwayne, and there's J-Mo, and there's a lot of the road crew were involved in this documentary. And wow, it just really took me back to the power that Dwayne had over all of us, not just the Allman Brothers Band, but being Southern musicians, the effect he had on all of us through his musicianship, but also through his leadership. He was a born leader, and everyone looked up to Duane, even if you, you know, might have been on the label but never met the guy. You knew about him. You'd heard him on all those wonderful records, that Muscle Shoals, where he recorded quite a lot, but also Miami and New York. He did sessions all over the place. And whether it was Aretha Franklin or Wilson Pickett or, you know, whoever it might be that he was working with, you knew the name Duane Allman. And he just exuded positivity and leadership qualities.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, he seemed like a very interesting guy. What a musician, right? Like, and the legacy he left is just, you know, it's incredible. And I know when you were in the Allman Brothers, the piano was mostly like, you know, an accompany instrument. It wasn't totally lead. But then when you joined in, you had to make it more of a lead instrument, right?
Well, absolutely, yes. And, you know, the thing is, having lost Duane with the motorcycle accident in 1971, that's a person you just do not replace, right? And there were rumors, I remember, going around, hey, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, or, you know, there was other Southern guitar players that were quite good, names were mentioned. But it would have been a wrong decision to try to replace Duane. And it was a very gutsy thing for the band to go out as a five-piece band with no replacement and putting all that pressure on Dickie Betts. Dickie had never played slide before, and he had to bone up and pony up to learn all those parts on certain songs that slide guitar was essential to have. And he did an incredibly admirable job of it. He really did. It was great. So when we started the Laid Back album, well, let me just back up and say that as a five-piece band, the Allman Brothers went out and played some 90 shows that were on the books for them to play. And when they came back off that tour, they were physically exhausted, mentally exhausted. They needed a break. They were taking a break. Greg wanted to do a solo album. He had some songs that he felt didn't quite fit the Allman Brothers. I got called in for those sessions, and we started the process for Greg. Everything was going great. A different set of musicians. I mentioned earlier Scott Boyer and Tommy Talton. They were in the mix. And so then the brothers, which were, even though they were taking a break, they were still hanging out and making. And these jam sessions occurred late at night after we would be recording Greg. And that would include all the Allman Brothers. You know, J-Mo came down, Butch, Dickie Betts, Barry Oakley. And it was just fantastic. I mean, you know, no one had thought about, hey, let's add a piano to the Allman Brothers band, or let's add another instrument. It was just a happy accident. But the jam sessions went really, really well. We might do a brother song. We might do an old blues classic, or we might just pick a key and go, you know. And so after about 2 weeks of this, started feeling pretty good, and I get a call from Phil Walden, the band's manager and the founder of Capricorn. I want to see you in my office. Oh God, what have I done wrong? You know, I was barely 20 years old. You have to understand that. So I walk into the office wondering what the heck was going on. And there's all the guys in the band around the room, you know, and the shoe dropped. And they said, you know, this little experiment we've been doing seems to be going very, very well. The band is interested in doing another album, and they are interested in having you join the band. So that's the way it went.
Yeah, I mean, well, what a moment that must have been, right? You must have, that's a jaw hit the floor kind of thing, right?
It's not something I had to think about more than about a nanosecond.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, when you joined the band, though, I'm guessing your style had to change slightly, right? Just to adapt, you know, what the Allman Brothers had already set out in their earlier days.
Well, I think it really helped that I knew the Allman Joys, that I knew the Hourglass, and that many times we opened up shows for the Allman Brothers when I was working with Alex Taylor, and also when I worked with Dr. John. So, you know, I had heard them multiple times. I'd listened to their records. I knew the style, I admired the style, and it was not that difficult for me to figure out a way to come in there and make a contribution without taking it too far in some different direction.
Well, yeah, I guess you already knew the repertoire, right? So it wouldn't take that long to adjust.
And there's one more story, and that is sometimes when we would open either with Alex or with Dr. John for the brothers, I always used an acoustic piano, even if it was an upright piano. But I didn't back then, you know, the digital pianos were not very good. And even though you had Wurlitzers and Fender Rhodes pianos, I wanted the acoustic. So we would set up, we would play our set. They would pull our equipment to the back of the stage. The Allman Brothers would set up, but there's that piano sitting backstage, you know, before they, that usually it wouldn't go off the stage until the very end of the night. So I would sit at that piano while the Allman Brothers were playing and play along with them. And you know, nobody knew about it except for the roadies. Sometimes the roadies would be passing by because they're backstage walking back and forth. And, you know, they'd put a little ear on and stop for a second and listen to me. So it gave me a little mysterious and unknown introduction to playing with them.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I guess it's got to happen somehow, right? And you figured it out in a way that's, I guess, different than most. That's funny. And I know one Allman Brothers song that you're obviously very famous for is the Dickie Betts song Jessica, right? I mean, that I'm guessing you get this one a lot, but you know, when you heard that song, how did you know what to do? How did you know how to make that your own?
Well, you know, it just naturally lent itself to a keyboard feature, to a piano feature. Dickie had written the song. He had been listening to Django Reinhardt, who is this gypsy guitar player from the 1930s era, who played a very bouncy type chord patterns when he wasn't soloing. His chord patterns were very bouncy and moving around. And he was watching his daughter Jessica at play and listening to Django. And somehow he came up with that intro that's the acoustic guitar intro to Jessica. After he, you know, got that going, a melody came to him and he presented it to the band. We all sat around while he played it. He had his friend at the time, Les Dudak, helping him play guitar so he could play the melody, and Les was playing the intro. And, you know, once I heard the melody, and here's the thing, you know, the Allman Brothers obviously were known for harmony guitar parts, right, between Dwayne and Dickie. And so we wanted to maintain that theory, but we didn't have two guitars. Well, we did, you know, overdubbing on recording, but we did it with two keyboards, you know. So Greg was playing organ. I'm playing, actually, on the record, I'm playing my part of the melody on a Fender Rhodes. But I did play the melody on the Rhodes, and then I played the solo and the rest of the parts on acoustic piano. And of course it was Dickie's song, but you know, when you're working something like that up, everybody contributes a little bit. And so I had some arrangement ideas, you know, the breakdown section before the piano solo, and then how do we get from the piano solo to the guitar solo? And I came up with that little ascending line that leads into Dickie's solo. And so, you know, it just felt very, very natural to me. It was a perfect piano song. And let's face it, instrumentals don't usually create hits, even back then. I mean, you might have something, if you remember, Edgar Winter had Frankenstein, and Billy Preston had a hit, Space something, I forget the name of that song. But it was very, very rare to get played on the radio, AM or FM, with an instrumental song, especially one that was 7 minutes long, right? But somehow people gravitated to it, and it got a lot of requests through the radio. You know, play that new Allman Brothers instrumental, you know. And it was just a wonderful vehicle for me. And as far as the solo goes, it was part thought out and part improvised. I wanted to come up with something that would be, especially in the first part of it, something that would be kind of consistent and hey, I'm here sort of, you know, I don't want to get too fancy on the first few lines, but I wanted to make an entrance that would be noticed. And then from there to build it up into what the solo is. And, you know, it's funny because, I mean, when I play that song now, I certainly embellish the intro to it. I mean, excuse me, the solo to a degree. But if I don't play it pretty much like the original, people get upset. So it's nice to know that it's made its mark.
Yeah. I mean, does that ever seem kind of restricting that you're kind of stuck to exactly what you played on the record in the 70s?
Well, it's a compliment to me. You know, it's a compliment that people remember that, and they remember most all the notes that I played. I'm not going to play it exactly the same every night, but I'm going to stick to the basics of it, and then I can embellish here and there, which is fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, as someone who's done all of these live things with the Stones, the Allmans, all of that, would you say you're a bigger fan of like the more organized, like short song, or like the more improvisational, like jam band kind of style?
Well, I think it really depends on the setting. You know, with the Stones, most of the songs lend themselves to being concise. You know, there's verse, chorus sort of format with a middle eight in there and a solo section, blah, blah, blah. But you take a song like Can't You Hear Me Knocking? Now that's got room to stretch. And that's a very fun song to play with the Rolling Stones. Although I must say, Mick, God bless him, I think during the long solo sections, he finds himself with not a whole lot to do except maybe shake some maracas. So he gets a little bored, you know. He's like, I want to be Mick Jagger here, you know. And so he kind of, every time that song comes up, we'll rehearse it, but he's not so keen to do it, you know, often, let's put it that way. But it'll pop up every now and then. And I love playing that song. And but when you're asking the questions, what do I prefer? I think it depends on the setting. You know, with the Stones, again, something like Jumpin' Jack Flash or, you know, Can't Always Get What You Want or Start Me Up. You know, those are pretty concise songs that need to stick basically to the arrangement. But when you take a Jessica or you take a In Memory of Elizabeth Reed or Whippin' Post, Mountain Jam, or any of those songs that we used to do with the Allman Brothers, you know, they need to be stretched out. I mean, they're made for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I know the style of the Allman Brothers and the Stones were kind of different. Did you really have to adapt to get from one group to the other? Did it just come naturally like it did when you joined the Allmans?
You know, it came quite naturally. In the case of the Stones, again, you have to appreciate that, you know, my first band was when I was 13, 14, 15 years old. What did we play? We played a heck of a lot of British Invasion. So, you know, I knew those Stones songs. I used to play guitar. So I remember one of the first riffs I learned was the riff in The Last Time, the song The Last Time. And I've been quite comfortable. You know, when I went to the audition in 1981, I got called in at the suggestion of Bill Graham, who was tour director for the Stones during that tour, the 81 tour. And, you know, it was a great honor. I get this call sort of out of the blue. Hey, the Rolling Stones would like you to audition. Well, okay. Well, how do I feel about that? Well, my thought was, okay, Chuck, you played most all this stuff when you were 14, 15 years old. You know the basics of those early songs. They had the new record Tattoo You out at the time, so I had to give that a listen and try to, you know, feel like I could play some of those songs on the audition. But the real thought was, okay, first of all, great opportunity. Second of all, we all put our pants on the same way, you know, we're all the same. So don't, you know, don't get in a hussy about anything about it. Just go have fun. Go enjoy yourself. The worst thing that can happen is you're going to have a good time. You get the gig, great. You don't get the gig, you had a good time. So there's no negative outcome from this one way or the other.
Yeah. Wow. Well, what were your first thoughts when you played your first gig with the Stones? I'd be very interested to know, because that's a big deal. If the Allman Brothers aren't a big deal, and the Allman Brothers are a big deal, the Stones are are a big deal.
Well, the first gig was at a club, and it was just absolutely fantastic. It was just so much fun, you know, to play with the Stones in that setting. And one of the thoughts I had was, boy, the audience sure is having a good time, because I would love to see this. Mick and Keith and Bill, and, you know, of course, Bill Wyman was in the band when I joined. And Charlie, oh God, I miss Charlie so much. But it was just tremendous fun, just, you know, to look at the smiles on the people's faces and to be playing that music. It was a special honor. And, you know, that was 42 years ago, so I've been doing this for a little while now.
Yeah, wow, yeah. I guess you're really in it. Like, you, the Stones, that's a huge deal. And I know they just put out the record Hackney Diamonds. And I was looking, and I didn't see you credited on it. Was that just a crediting error, or were you not playing on that one?
No, I was not invited to the sessions. Mm-hmm. And would I have liked to have been there? Well, yeah, but to be honest with you, I had a lot going on during that time when they were in the studio in L.A. And that's not the only time that has happened throughout the career. The only other record I've not been involved in was Bridges to Babylon. And so, you know, look, it's their game, right? And it doesn't hurt my feelings that they have certain ideas of the way they want to do things when it comes to recording. And I respect that. I'm okay with it. Do I think the record would have been better with me on it? Hell yeah. and I can make those songs better. I have no doubt about that. But, it, you know, honestly, I had a lot going on here at my place, Charlaine. We had several projects going on, harvesting some timber, doing prescribed burns, planting trees, doing a lot of management practices, forestry management practices on the place. So it gave me time to do these things, and not to forget that I do a lot of solo work on my own. So I had a lot of gigs either with my band or with me as a solo artist, or we have a presentation where we do a 30-minute edited version of my documentary. And then I come out on stage with a moderator with some scripted questions that allow me to tell certain stories and play certain songs. And so, you know, I can do a career retrospective of anything from Allman Brothers Band to Eric Clapton to George Harrison to Rolling Stones to my own solo work, and David Gilmour, that I had the pleasure of playing on his last tour. So those are fun presentations to do, and they work out quite well for me.
Wow. Well, that's quite a roster you have there. Geez. I mean, you got some Beatle, you got a member of Pink Floyd. Like, you've really played on a lot of different stuff, a lot of different styles of music. And I'd be curious to know with David Gilmour, like, that seems like a totally different kind of music than what you're used to playing, right?
It is quite different. The way we got to know each other was way back in the 80s. I was musical director on an event called, I think it was called Guitar Greats. And I put the band together to back up all these different guitar players. Dickie Betts was on it. And this is after I had left the Allman Brothers Band. But of course, we were still friends. And so Dickie was on the show. Tony Iommi was on the show. Lita Ford. Link Wray, if you know who he is, one of the early guitar heroes in the, you know, the history of guitar. Neil Sean was on the event. And David was on. And so it was, the rehearsal was like, okay, you know, send us in advance the songs you want to do. We learn the songs, we go to the rehearsal prepared, you get one shot at rehearsal, and then the next day is the show. So it's a lot of pressure. You got to get it right in a short amount of time. Well, it went very well, you know. And then I didn't hear from David for something like 10 years. And I think it was, we were rehearsing for the George Harrison tour in London, and he was kind of hanging around. And he invited myself and a couple of the other guys in the band to come to his amazing house at the time. I should say castle, probably. it was just beautiful. And we just had a good time. We drank some wine, talked music, hung out. And he was just very, very nice to me and to everybody that was there. Well, then another 10 years go by, and my wife is looking on the guest book of my website. And she said, there's a guy here who says he's David Gilmour and he wants to talk to you. And I said, really? And he left a phone number and an email address. And I said, well, I'll do the email and see what happens. But the message that he wrote to me was, hey, Chuck, David Gilmour here, ... honest. So I said, well, it's probably worth it. It may be a scam, but it's worth a try, right? And I answered. He answered back. He said, let's talk. And we got on the phone finally. And he said, listen, I want to shake my band up a little bit. I'd love for you to come in. I'm going to do a European tour. And I said, well, gosh, you know, are you kidding me? I'm honored. I'm flattered. And yes, I am available. And I said, but David, it's been a long time since we played together. I mean, do you want me to come over there in advance and, you know, sit with you and just go through some songs or something? He said, nope. I know who you are. I know what you do. If you can make it, just come on. And that was a real honor. That was a real honor for him to, you know, to have that much faith in me.
Yeah, I mean, that must have been real flattering for someone like that to be like, yeah, I know you're Chuck. I mean, that's wow.
It was quite an honor. It really was, and very flattering. And he's such a beautiful human being, David. And we have something else in common. You know, he told me a story that when he got out of high school, you know, you go see a counselor usually to help you decide what your career move might be. And after spending time with the counselor, he came out and the counselor said, I think you should be a forester. So we have a whole different thing in common. And I've been to his beautiful place over in England, and he's planted a lot of trees throughout his property. And so we have a lot in common in that regard as well. But the real shocker for me, Sam, was when the last song of rehearsal came up and we were doing Comfortably Numb, and he asked me if I wanted to sing on it. And my first thought was in the choruses or something. And I said, well, yeah, I'll do that. And he said, well, you do the counterpart. Oh, okay then. And how fun was that? How fun was that? That was a real, real treat.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, Comfortably Numb, that's almost as much of an anthem as, you know, Jessica. I mean, both of those are about on the same league. That's quite a song to play on. That is quite an honor. Wow. And I mean, Chuck, your whole musical career here is just so like interesting to hear about. You know, there's so much that you've done. You've really done everything from the Almonds to the Stones to, I guess, even Gilmour. Like that's really something. So, I mean, thank you for talking to me here. This has just been so fascinating to hear about.
Been a blessing, Sam. Thank you for inviting me, and I hope we can do it again sometime. And yeah, I really look forward to this tour with the Stones. It's remarkable. It's just insane that we get to continue to do this. You know, when I first got to gig, Sam, I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great if I could have this gig for 3, 4, maybe even 5 years? That would be amazing. And here we are, 42, almost 43 years later, still doing it. And wow. So it's a joy. It's a pleasure. It's an honor. And I love those guys. It's a family, you know.
Yeah.
You don't spend time together all those years without becoming a family. You watch your children grow up together. You watch your grandchildren come in to the picture. And I just love those guys. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Chuck. It's been great talking to you. I'm Sam Padore, and I hope you enjoyed that interview with Chuck Lavelle. Chuck is just an amazing musician, and he's played with the Stones, with David Gilmour, and of course with the Allman Brothers. So if you did enjoy that interview, make sure to check out mybackpages.org to hear many great interviews just like this one.